Hello and welcome to Meandering with Myrne, a potpourri of podcasts by me, veterinary ethologist Myrne Milani. Join me as I ponder any and all things animal and human, what we know and what we don't, where we've been, where we are, and where we're headed.
Do you catastrophize your animal's behavior? You may be thinking, well, I might if I knew what catastrophizing was. I felt the same way when I heard the word the first time. It's what we used to call a melodramatic, exaggerated, histrionic, or over-the-top response to something perceived as negative. However, in the academic world of human behavior and medicine, catastrophizing refers to people who believe that the physical or behavioral pain they experience is far worse than it actually is. The response gained attention when it emerged as a primary factor in chronic pain perception. People who catastrophize their pain fear that they can't handle it without drugs. And that belief ranks as the primary driver of opioid addiction. This got me thinking about if and how this phenomenon plays out in animals. The short answer is that I decided it can, and it does, occur. And that it also may occur in people with companion animals. It also might be more prevalent than it used to be. As always, though, context takes center stage when we talk about any kind of behavior. We live in a society that rewards drama. The squeaky wheel may not get any grease or any other needed repairs, but it will get more likes, better ratings, or other treats than a quiet one. Whether this works depends on what the squeaky wheel or animal or person wants. Continuing our analysis of behavior in terms of ethology, catastrophizing takes a lot of energy. Applying a basic cost-benefit analysis enables us to determine whether catastrophizing represents a viable approach for an animal in that environment. Because it uses so much energy, it seems reasonable that any wild animal who opts for this approach most likely won't last long in the wild. There are multiple reasons for this. Reducing the amount of energy available would interfere with the animal's ability to fulfill basic mind-body needs. These include undermining the animal's ability to establish and protect their physical and mental spaces, find food and water, court, mate, reproduce, and raise their young. Lack of energy also would inhibit effective healing and learning. Meanwhile, any exaggerated behaviors would attract competitors or predators that would further decrease the catastrophizing wild animal's chances of survival in the wild. Wild animals in captivity prone to catastrophizing might fare better. However, whether they do would depend on the human response to the behavior. When animals devote the bulk of their energy to catastrophizing, caregivers must possess the knowledge and resources to do all the things for the animals that the animals refuse to do for themselves. At the same time, though, they must do this in a way that doesn't reinforce this kind of animal behavior, because they don't want to reinforce the negative effects this has on the animal's physical and behavioral health. How much time these skilled staff members would have to devote to this would depend on the needs of any other animals in their care. But what if we replaced our skilled caregiver with a catastrophizing one? Given the increased demands these animals place on caregivers, a caregiver prone to catastrophizing probably wouldn't last long. Not only would these exaggerated human responses upset rather than comfort the ill or injured animal, they could endanger other caregivers as well as the animals. In zoos, wildlife rehabilitation facilities, or preserves, caregivers prone to catastrophizing the animal's problems would be a liability, not an asset. A survey of social and other forms of media reveals that catastrophizing may play out quite differently in the human-companion-animal bond. Just as some people seem to enjoy catastrophizing the pain of their own physical or emotional problems, they may enjoy doing likewise for their animals' problems too. But while this may make them feel better, doing so may interfere with their animals' ability to heal. Recall that social learning and emotional contagion are the primary forms of learning in young animals. This also applies to their interactions with us. And because domestication results in animals who are more physiologically and behaviorally immature compared to their wild ancestors, our pets retain this orientation throughout their lives. They expect us to take care of them as well as ourselves, or rather, they would if they could. If the message we give our animals catastrophizes what they're experiencing, any physical or behavioral animal healing that occurs will need to occur in spite of us instead of with our help and support. For example, suppose Ms. Argyle tells anyone who will listen that she loves her dog Muffy more than anyone in the world. To prove this, she points to all the creature comforts she supplies for him. A backyard agility course her dog-owning friends envy. Multiple cushy dog beds spread throughout the house. Pricey canine diets and treats. Enough toys to enrich the lives of 100 dogs. All because she loves him so much. But when Muffy attempts to bite the letter carrier, she completely goes to pieces. When others try to explain how she can help her dog, she doesn't hear them. Instead, tears stream down her face. She wrings her hands. She goes on and on about how much she loves him and how she can't stand the thought that he'd do this to her. Time and time again, she tells herself and others, it's all too much. It's all more than she can bear. In such a way, alleviating the pain generated by catastrophizing becomes Ms. Argyle's top priority, not supporting her fearful dog's recovery in any way she can. The problem, Muffy's aggression, gets replaced by her need to relieve the pain caused by her response to it as quickly as possible. This may mean drugs or other substances to dull her pain. It also may mean seeking instant cures for her dog's problem, which she perceives as the cause of her pain. Or perhaps a combination of two. Or maybe giving Muffy lots of drugs too. Anything that makes her feel better as fast as possible. Meanwhile, what's going on with the animal component of this human-animal relationship? Lacking a supportive physical and emotional human role model who relieves him from his overwhelming responsibilities, Muffy is on his own. If he harms someone, he may be euthanized. If he zeroes out his owner's influence and ignores her and any need to protect her, he may relax and his behavior may improve. Either way, the result is a human-animal bond few of us would envy. We all experience times when it would be much easier to catastrophize than view a problematic situation more calmly and rationally. But when our animals need us, summoning the strength and courage to support them is the most loving response we can make. And in the process of doing this, we may discover that we're a lot stronger than we thought we were, too.
You've been listening to a podcast by veterinary ethologist Myrna Milani. For more podcasts, commentaries, and books about animal behavior and the human-animal bond, and links to behavior and bond sites, check out my website at www.mmilani.com. For more specific information, feel free to email me at mm@mmilani.com. All rights related to the content of these podcasts are retained by Myrna Milani. The background music, Molly on the Shore by Percy Granger, is used with permission from Catova Arts, www.catova.com.